WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, filmmaking without a script. Mike Lee is known for his socially realistic films like High Hopes, Life is Sweet, and Naked, and for using improvisational techniques to develop the story and the characters. Lee's new film, Secrets and Lies, opens the New York Film Festival tomorrow night. We'll talk with Lee and with the two starring actresses. Also, we meet Broadway and film star Bernadette Peters. She has a new CD. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD of Joan Morris and Bill Balcombe, performing songs by Vincent Newmans. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Omens of Millennium, Harold Bloom's examination of the prophecies and hype surrounding the year 2000. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 34th New York Film Festival begins tomorrow night. The film given the honor of opening the festival is Secrets and Lies by British director Mike Lee. Earlier this year, Secrets and Lies won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival, and one of the film's stars, Brenda Blethyn, received the Best Actress Award. Lee's previous film, Naked, received Best Director and Best Actor Awards at Cannes. Secrets and Lies opens theatrically in America next month. Secrets and Lies is about an extended family and the secrets and deceptions which keep them apart. In a few minutes, we'll meet director Mike Lee, whose other films include High Hopes and Life is Sweet. First, we're joined by the two leading actresses, Brenda Blethyn and Marianne Jean-Baptiste. Acting in a Mike Lee film is an unusual process. The actors are cast before there is a script. The director and actors slowly develop the characters and the story through a series of long discussions and improvisations. Marianne Jean-Baptiste told me that each actor works with the director in developing the character's life story from infancy on.
In this process, one is expected to work out in infinite detail things about this character, i.e. do they scrub their teeth regularly, what brand of toothpaste they use, where they went to school, and you actually have to go out and find the school, find the road where the person lived.
And Brenda, how much do you know about the other characters when you're developing your own, and how much do you know about the fate of your character?
At the outset, we have absolutely no idea what sort of character we're going to be playing. Neither do we know how that character will fit into the overall scheme of things. We do not know any storyline. And it's rather liberating in a way, because the actor's only responsibility is to create with Mike the entire history for this person. And when he chooses to put that person at whichever state of development they're in into an improvisation, one's only responsibility is to act and react as that person would do. There's no pressure to be interesting, entertaining, and if nothing at all happens in an improvisation, then that's okay too, because that is what happens, nothing. So if the character is not in a particular scene, they do not know anything about that scene. They only know what they need to know, as in real life, really. I mean, I can't see you. I've no idea what you're doing and what you look like. You know, one might behave differently if one had information that one wouldn't normally have.
Oh, now, does that work for you? I mean, usually an actor knows what the ending of the film is when they start shooting the first scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, as I say, it's rather liberating because you don't have an end to reach. You just have to act in the moment, and therefore it's organic, it's real. You don't have to make anything happen.
I think with some actors that when people know what's going to happen, they preempt it. You know, it's like, you know, I keep using this example of somebody knowing that somebody's going to die in act four of a play, for example. And the whole play is built up and you get these performances and you kind of know this guy's going to die because everybody is sort of holding him lingeringly and, you know, sort of like staring into his eyes. And so, I mean, it's brilliant not knowing.
Let me give away one of the early plot twists. Marianne, your character Hortense finds out that her birth mother was really a white woman, although Hortense is black. And then Cynthia, you find out that a child that you gave away, you know, many years ago, is searching for you now, and you're shocked to find that that child is black. Marianne, when did you find out that your character's birth mother was white? Did you find that out in an improvisation, or did you know that before working on that scene?
No, that's not something that you would know before. It was discovered in improvisation, and you see it on film, actually, when she has the birth records and she looks along them and she sees that it says mother white, and she goes back to try and sort it out because she thinks it's a mistake. But that's when I found out as well.
but you weren't on camera when you found it, were you? That was through an earlier improvisation?
No, that was in an earlier improvisation.
How much are you expected to be in character when you're with Mike Lee or on the set? Are you sometimes supposed to be in character even when you're not officially in rehearsal?
If we're in character, we are working.
Yeah.
He's at the beginning of a session. We sit and talk objectively about certain things. And if we're going into an improvisation, Mike Lee will say, go into character. That means he's giving you time, say half an hour or however long it takes to prepare yourself to get into the costume and to get into the frame of mind of that character. And then you stay that way and you act and you behave as that character. You're absolutely honest to that person until he says the magic words come out of character. And similarly, he gives you the same amount of time to come out of character as well. And then you can talk about what happened in the improvisation objectively and privately with him.
Marianne, how does an improvisation start?
Oh, God.
What are you told before starting a scene?
Well, you'd probably discuss where you are, what's happening. Like, for example, Hortense has just come in from work She's going to get changed and she's going to... How does she feel? What's her day been like? We discuss that first, because obviously that will inform how she would be in the improvisation. And then you warm up for half an hour, 45 minutes, and then get in. I mean, where we rehearsed in this old school with loads of buildings in it. And, you know, there was sort of a mock-up of her apartment, you know, old horrible furniture, but it was good enough and you felt at home there. And she would just potter around in there sometimes on her own and nothing would happen. Nothing would happen, you know. Or I did an improvisation one time with him when she'd come in from... She'd just got her birth certificate and her friend popped over to see her. And, you know, that just went on. But basically, that's how they start. There's no sort of... You don't get any sort of instruction other than to be in that space and to explore feeling what she would be feeling and doing what she would be doing.
Now, you know, sometimes there's more than one improvisation going on at the same time, and obviously he can't be in two places at once, so he might go from one to the other, but you just have to carry on as your character would, even if he is not there. For instance, in the big scene at the end of the film that involves everybody... we all started that particular improvisation. We were all in different parts of London. For instance, Roxanne and Cynthia got ready to go to the party at from the rehearsal room, which was East London, and waiting for Paul to turn up and going out shopping to buy flowers and some beer. And then they really did take a taxi ride with a real taxi driver up to London and arrived at that house that they'd never been to before. Meanwhile, at another part in London, Marianne as Hortense is, what are you doing?
Oh, well, getting dressed. I had to drive from my flat, my real flat in London, to Hortense's flat in another part of London, then get dressed and get into character as Hortense, and then drive from her flat to this house. So it was just like... And then while that's happening, Morris and Monica are cooking and cleaning their house and chilling bottles of wine and things like that for the barbecue.
Now, you both don't always work this way. You've both done more conventional plays and movies.
Yeah.
So tell me what you think the pros and cons are of this method to working out a story and to understanding a character.
Oh, God.
Well, you create a complete... You invent a complete person. And when you're watching that person on the screen, you can watch them quite objectively. Because you know the entire history of that person. It's so divorced from oneself. Cynthia's nothing like Brenda. Her whole life experiences are nothing to do with me. And it's so rewarding. It also informs any other work I've done, working on a scripted piece. I'm very much more aware of finding out where this person has come from rather than just seeing the few clues that are there in the text.
Well, Marianne, let me ask you, don't you sometimes wish that you had a good script that was really well written and you could just
really
say
don't.
The lines? No.
I mean, during the process, by the time you've spent 8 months there, working in this way,
right.
And it's the hottest summer in London,
yeah.
And you know, he's getting on your nerves and stuff like that, you kind of think it would be lovely just to have a script and just to not, you know, have to sort of think so much. But I mean, I love this way of working because it's so rich, you know, and you really get to explore something else, someone completely different from yourself. I mean, you just, when we watch the film, I speak for Brenda as well, and I have to because I can see her and I know what she's like. You're watching completely different people up there. It's really weird. You don't think, oh my God, I look awful in that scene, or look at that, or that. You kind of think, oh, look at her. It's weird. It's a really weird thing. You know, you really do see them as people that are outside of yourself. Mm. Where in other things that I've done, it's me. And I'm going, oh, God, you shouldn't have said that like that. And that didn't sound convincing or whatever. But with this, I don't know, you just kind of... Enjoy it.
Brenda Blethyn and Marianne Jean-Baptiste star in Mike Leigh's new film Secrets and Lies. Here's their first scene together in the film. Hortense, played by Jean-Baptiste, has just found out the name of her birth mother and tracked down the phone number.
Hello?
I'm sorry to trouble you, but I'm trying to locate a Cynthia Purley.
Yes?
Is that Cynthia Purley?
Yes.
Cynthia Rose Purley?
Yes.
Of 76 Quilter Street.
Is... what is it you want, darling? Hello? Did you want Roxanne? She's gone out.
No.
She ain't in any trouble, is she?
No, it's about Elizabeth.
Elizabeth? Elizabeth who?
Elizabeth Purley.
Oh, I mean, she's dead.
No, she isn't.
She is, darling. I should know.
I should know.
Look, sweetheart, she's my mother. She went in 1961.
No, I mean baby Elizabeth Purley.
Baby Elizabeth? Who is this?
Coming up, we meet the director of Secrets and Lies, Mike Leigh. This is Fresh Air. Mike Leigh is one of England's most respected directors. He develops the scripts for his films out of long series of discussions and improvisations with the actors. But I wanted to know if when he cast the actors for Secrets and Lies, if he had already figured out one of the film's basic premises, that a black woman is tracking down her birth mother who turns out to be white.
Well, it's a question with no answer, really, because the point is that I... started off, as I always do with my films, with various ideas and feelings and notions floating around. And the job really was one of creating this whole reality, this whole world. And in constructing the backstory of Cynthia, the mother, when she was a teenager, we did certainly create, you know, we invented the fact that she had a baby that was given away for adoption. We'd also built into the story that at a certain point in the game, in a very incidental way, she'd had this sexual encounter with a black guy.
Did you know that before you even brought the actresses on? Or did that didn't happen until you...
No, we invented that. Having
together?
Yes. If you're asking me whether I knew what the story was going to be when I cast the actresses...
That's
the
what I'm asking,
no.
Yeah. Right, so you just just cast interesting people and then work out the
story?
Well,
no, I cast character actors so that we have a great... the infinite number of possibilities as to the kind of characters we can create. I don't cast actors who just play themselves. I mean, these sort of actors, and indeed the actors that you saw in Naked and Life is Sweet and High Hopes, etc., are the kind of actors who are versatile, who are character actors, who can play different kinds of people.
Now, clarify for me what you know that actors in the movie don't know as you go about this process together.
I mean, before I talk about that, I think the important thing is that this is a film, and it's a dramatic, constructed, finished piece of work, which you see on the screen. And what you're asking me about is a very complicated process that finally arrives at the film. It's the kind of foundations. And what you're asking me about, really, is way before that, which in the case of Secrets and Lies was like 5 months before that, where we began to work... to create this whole world out of which I eventually distilled and constructed the film. Now, as with all pieces of work, whether you're going to paint a picture or write a novel or compose a symphony or whatever you're going to do, there is a point at which you kind of, an artist, doesn't know quite what he or she is going to do. And then gradually, as you begin to work into it and to experiment and to explore things, the investigation of doing it leads to the discovery and the definition of what it actually is. Now, that's all I do, except that I admit actors to it, share the creative process with them, so that there isn't a kind of artificial division between the invention of the characters or the writing of the characters and the acting.
But more specifically, my impression is that at some point you know all the pieces of the puzzle. You see the whole picture, but each of the actors only knows what's happening to their character at that moment.
That is the case right down the line, right down to the last day of filming, in a sense. But that in order for each actor to be absolutely truthful and spontaneous, in order for us to be able to make it all work like real life, which is what we're trying to do, what it's all about, it makes sense for each actor to know no more than his or her character would actually know. And you've been talking to Marianne Jean-Baptiste and Brenda Blethyn, and it's important that they knew at no stage of the game did either of them know any more about the whole thing than their characters, each of their characters, would actually know. So that it means that in a situation, whether you're talking about one of the improvisations, of which there were millions, leading to the material, or actually playing in the scenes themselves, once we'd constructed them and structured them and scripted them and rehearsed them, they would not be fettered or cluttered or distracted or diffused or confused by having an overview or knowledge about other characters, so that everything is absolutely truthful and organic. Whereas I have an overview. My job is a job as a storyteller. I mean, I sharing with my cinematographer and editor and designer and everything, we have an overview. We are telling a story.
When the camera is actually rolling, is there a script that the actors are working off of?
Absolutely. It is more precise than any sort of film, because they spent months and months becoming really solid in the characters, and then we rehearse each scene in a very, very precise way, so that they then are able to soar and be free within a very, very tightly scripted and structured and rehearsed scene.
Are there aspects of stage and film performance that often strike you as phony? In other words, is your technique a reaction to things that you see as phony in a lot of acting?
Yes, actually, and that really traces itself back to my earliest experiences as a child growing up in the 1940s and a teenager in the 50s in Manchester in the north of England, going to the movies all the time and watching any number of Hollywood and British movies and thoroughly enjoying them, but still being aware of a tension between the tinsel world that I was looking at on the screen and the grey, industrial, northern world full of real people out there in the street, and thinking endlessly, you know, wouldn't it be great, I used to think, if you could see people in movies, characters in movies, like people, like real people actually are. So it's it's a reaction. I mean, you're right to discern such a reaction. It goes back a very long way with me, certainly.
You know, I think that you as a director are this really interesting combination of someone who grants actors an incredible amount of freedom, because they're actually creating the character, they're helping to create the story. And on the other hand, it sounds like you're the ultimate control freak because you're forcing all the characters to keep secrets from each other. You're forcing the crew to not tell the actors what's going on in other people's scenes. You're keeping the actors under your spell for a really long period of time, telling them that they can't go out of character until you tell them to.
I think your analysis is totally accurate. but, I mean, you know, if I wasn't, as you put it, a control freak, I mean, you wouldn't get a film, basically. Because,
right.
I mean, you know, films don't make themselves, and films are not, making films is not, you know, a therapy session or, you know, certainly isn't an exercise in fireside democracy. It's, you know, making films is a very complicated and elaborate way of storytelling. And my responsibility is to tell a story in a coherent and meaningful way. And, you know, of course, I'm concerned to tell the kinds of stories, to make the kind of films in which, as I gather is the case with Secrets and Lies, audiences are moved to a point of crying and laughing and feeling what these people are going through. Now, I mean, it's all very well. I mean, you may, you know, people may be bothered about whether I am or other people involved are control freaks or whatever. But the fact is, it is a job of work we have to do. It's a practical business. Filmmaking is very complicated, particularly the kind of films where, you know, you want to be out there in the real world, shooting on location in real places, but at the same time to make a film that is looks good and is disciplined and controlled in the artistic sense.
Do you ever want to try a more conventional approach and just kind of hand people scripts one time and shoot and see what happens?
No.
Why not?
Same as I don't want to go to Hollywood.
And why not?
Well, it would be dreadful, and it wouldn't. I mean, I wouldn't know how to make it work, really. I mean, you only live one life, and it takes a lifetime to work out how to do a thing properly, and that's the thing what I'm trying to do, really. So I wouldn't want to waste time on other people are better at that than I would be, I think.
Mike Lee, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mike Lee's Secrets and Lies opens the New York Film Festival tomorrow night and opens nationally next month. This is Fresh Air. Coming up, Lord Schwartz reviews a new CD of songs by Vincent Humans, who wrote Tea for Two and Sometimes I'm Happy. We meet actress and singer Bernadette Peters, and Maureen Corrigan reviews Omens of Millennium, Harold Bloom's examination of the prophecies associated with the year 2000. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Of all the major classic American songwriters, Vincent Humans is among the least known. Music critic Lord Schwartz confesses he knew very little about Humans except for some of his most popular songs. A new CD of Humans songs has just been released by the husband and wife team of pianist William Balcom and mezzo-soprano Joan Morris, joined by tenor Robert White. Here's Lloyd's review.
When you're down and out, lift up your head and shout, there's gonna be a great day. Angels in the sky promise that by and by there's gonna be a great day. Gabriel will warn you, some early morn you will hear his horn. Rooty tootin', it's not far away. Hold up your hands and say, there's gonna be a great day.
We probably know more songs composed by Vincent Humans than we know who wrote them. Tea for Two, Sometimes I'm Happy, I Want to Be Happy, Time on My Hands, Flying Down to Rio in 1933, more about the novelty of flying than about Rio, and Without a Song are among his standards. Unlike George Gershwin, Richard Rodgers, Cole Porter, or Irving Berlin, Humans neither wrote his own lyrics nor stuck with one or two partners. He's more like Harold Arlen, who wrote in so many different genres it's harder to identify his personal style. There's another reason for his relative mystery. When I think of the person who wrote these songs, I imagine a gray-haired, cigar-smoking old pro. But Humans, it turns out, published only about 90 songs in a career that lasted barely 15 years. He died in 1946 at the age of 48 of complications from TB, depression, and alcohol. Hard to imagine about the person who wrote so many songs with happy in their titles. A new album by pianist William Balcom and the marvelous mezzo-soprano Joan Morris is devoted to familiar and extremely unfamiliar songs by Humans and his numerous collaborators. Morris is a fascinating anomaly. Her trained voice and perfect diction are really right out of the early decades of this century. Singers like Helen Morgan, Libby Hallman, and Ruth Etting. Yet she has a knowing, contemporary edge. She understands the style of this music from a long perspective. Listen to Robert White beginning the duet to Gus Kahn and Edward Eliscu's super-saturated romantic lyric of Orchids in the Moonlight.
When orchids fade in the dawning, they speak of tears and goodbye. Though my dreams are shattered like the petals scattered, still my love can never die. There is peace.
Then listen to Joan Morris. White sings it fairly straight. Morris knows there's something excessive, even absurd about the song, yet she still convinces you that she feels every syllable.
When orchids fade in the dawning, they speak of tears and goodbye. Though my dreams are shattered like the petals scattered, still my love can never die.
Pulitzer Prize-winning composer, pianist William Balcom is the perfect accompanist. He and Morris remind us what a complex and versatile composer Humans was. The writer of such uplifting spirituals as Great Day and Hallelujah could also write sentimental Irish ballads and a not-quite-nonsensical charmer called Toodaloo with lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein, one of several songs here getting its very first recording.
Toodaloo, I'll be never weary, dearie, being true to you, true as blue.
Joan Morris and Robert White are also delicious in Tea for Two, with Humans's typical insistent and sexy repetitions that are so conducive to multiple rhymes, like Irving Caesar's amazing, "We won't have it known, dear, that we own a telephone, dear." And Morris delivers one of the greatest torch songs ever written, "More Than You Know."
Loving you the way that I do, there's nothing I can do about it. Loving may be all you can give, but honey,
pleasure to hear these gems treated with such grown-up feeling, taste, intelligence, and wit, just as they were meant to be.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Orchids in the Moonlight, Songs of Vincent Eumanns, with William Baucom, Joan Morris, and Robert White on the Arabesque label.
I'm discontented with homes that are rented, so I have invented my own.
Darling, this place is a lover's oasis where life's weary chases are known.
Far from the cry of the city, where flowers pretty caress the streams, cozy to hide in.
To live side by side in.
Don't let it abide in my dreams. Picture you upon my knee, just tea for two, and two for tea, just me for you, and you for me alone.
Nobody near us to see us or hear us, no friends or relations on weekend vacations.
We won't have it known, dear, that we own a telephone, dear.
Day will break, and I'll awake and start to bake a sugar cake
for me to take, for all the boys to see. We will raise a family,
a boy for you, a girl for me.
Oh, can't you see how happy we would be?
Coming up, we talk with Bernadette Peters. This is Fresh Air. Bernadette Peters has been performing since the age of 3 1/2. She's perhaps now best known for her starring roles in the Stephen Sondheim musicals Sunday in the Park with George and Into the Woods. She also starred in the Broadway productions of George M., On the Town, Mac and Mabel, and Song and Dance. She's appeared in the films The Jerk, Pennies from Heaven, and Slaves of New York. Now she has a new CD, which demonstrates that the songs that most appeal to her range from Broadway to rock and folk. The CD is called I'll Be Your Baby Tonight. Here's Bernadette Peters singing a song by Lyle Lovett.
I got big red lips, I got big brown eyes. If I treat it right, it's a big surprise. I never do anything that I said I would. I make him feel good, I make him feel good. He says, come here, baby. I say, no. He says, drive me here. I say, drive your own.
Bernadette Peters, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me about a couple of the songs that you chose for the new CD and why you chose them.
Well, I got influenced years ago by Harry Nilsson. One of his early albums started, opened with tap dancing. And I went, oh, this is so great. Because it's like saying, here, listen to this. And there's a beginning, and I always was intrigued with an album that had a beginning and an end. And so I opened it with the opening of a show, actually, of On the Town. The opening of On the Town, which I thought was a wonderful opening of a show, and the closing of it. So it has a beginning and it has an ending, the album. And in between, and Make Him Feel Good is a Lyle Lovett song, and I think Lyle Lovett is a great musician and a wonderful writer with great wit and a very soulful singer. His new album has a lot of soulful things on it.
On the new CD, you do a song from Into the Woods called No One Is Alone. It's a song that you don't sing in the show, but you do get to sing it here. Why did you want to do this particular Sondheim song?
It's just a beautiful song, and it keeps, all his songs just keep unfolding, meaning more and more things, and that one just has such hope in it. I like songs that uplift you in a way.
This is Bernadette Peters from her new CD. The CD is called I'll Be Your Baby Tonight, and this is the Stephen Sondheim song, No One Is Alone.
No one here to guide you. Now you're on your own. Only me beside you. Still, you're not alone. No one is alone. Truly, no one is alone. Sometimes people leave you halfway through the wood. Others may deceive you. You decide what's good. You decide alone. But no one is alone. People make mistakes. Fathers, mothers, people make mistakes. Holding to their own, thinking they're alone. Honor their mistakes. Everybody makes one another's terrible mistakes. Witches can be right.
That's Bernadette Peters from her new CD, I'll Be Your Baby Tonight. The song is from the Stephen Sondheim musical, Into the Woods. No, I might be wrong here, but I think he's commented that working with you is interesting because you sing in a chest voice.
He said that?
I think I read him saying that.
Yeah, that's right. He had to change the role of Dot. He actually, when he with Mandy and myself, he actually had George in the baritone and Dot in the soprano. And when he got us, he had to reverse it because Mandy's the tenor and I was the chest.
Oh, so on Sunday in the Park with George, he had to reverse the roles?
Well,
musically?
He hadn't finished. He was writing it as he got to know us. But when he first started writing it, that was his vision to. And then he had to slowly, when we were cast, he was writing it while we were doing it because we did a workshop first. That's when he was writing it. He then had to accommodate the voices like that.
Yeah, because Mandy Patinkin has a pretty high voice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Let's hear Sunday in the Park with George from the cast recording. And this is from the opening of the show when you play the lover and model of the painter Georges Seurat, played by Mandy Patinkin. And you're in the park together, you're modeling, and he's painting a portrait of you. And you're very uncomfortable and very fed up.
A trickle of sweat. The back of the head. He always does this. Now the foot is dead. Sunday in the park with George. One more. The collar is damp. Beginning to pinch. The bustle slipping. I won't budge one inch. Who was at the zoo, George? Who was at the zoo? to George or Miss Fixed Cold. I like that in a man. Fixed Cold. God, it's hot out here. Well, there are worse things than staring at the water on a Sunday. There are worse things than staring at the water as you're posing for a picture being painted by your lover in the middle of the summer on an island in the river on a Sunday.
My guest is Bernadette Peters, and she has a new CD of a variety of different kinds of songs called I'll Be Your Baby Tonight. In Sunday in the Park with George, you have to sing some things very, very quickly. And that's something Sondheim's done in several of his songs over the years. Did you ever flub the fast parts during a performance?
I did, once. And what happened was, and Steve was there that night, and he said, it's amazing how you knew when the end was, because I was totally lost in the lyrics. So, but I knew musically somehow where I was. And I knew that one more, and then I sing the last note. Somehow I knew that. Well, how? I don't know, but I did.
So you got back on track.
And don't ask me what I said, you know. You know, who knows, dancing in the river and sitting on the, who knows, you know, but.
Blah, 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 et cetera.
yeah, exactly.
You got into show business when you were really young, 3 years old, I think? You were
not that young, 3 and a half.
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, well, forgive me for exaggerating. And you made your appearance on a TV show called Juvenile Jury. What was the show?
It was a show where you'd come on and you'd have a problem, and the this little jury of children would give their opinion and help you solve your problem. And I came on with a problem, and I remember I was 3 and a half, and I remember vividly thinking, my problem's not good enough. It's not dramatic enough.
What was your problem?
I think it was that I didn't like to take taxi cabs. No, I didn't like to take buses. I didn't like to take buses. And he said, what do you like to take? I said, I like to take taxi cabs. A little spoiled thing, even at 3 and a half.
And what was your advice?
And they said, well, what do you think? You think that your father has $100? That's what the kids said. And I said, he spends it on candy. He spends that on candy, I'm saying to this little boy. So that's all I remember about it, seeing it.
So did your parents want you to go into show business when you were young?
My sister went to the High School of Performing Arts, and my mother said I sang in front of the television. So I kind of was my mother's. I kind of found myself in show business. But my mother and I had a pact that if I didn't like it, I could leave any time I wanted.
Well, how'd they get you started when you were three?
Oh, just take you to singing lessons and auditions, and you know, you get a children's agent and all that kind of stuff, and then you go around on auditions.
So they must have. Your parents must have wanted this for you to go to the effort of getting an agent.
Oh, my mother was very intrigued, because she wanted to be an actress, but her mother wouldn't let her, because they were Italian, strict Italian. So she thought this would be great for her children. And she was right, I think. So.
Right. And your sister, I think, went on to become a casting agent?
Yes, she's a very successful casting agent, Donna DeSetta.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How do you think your looks have affected the roles that you've gotten over the years on stage and screen?
Well, I think I do have a period look, and I think it's, and I think that I've always had a unique look, and I think that's been in my favor. I'd never get a job in the chorus. I tried, but no one would hire me because I didn't fit in. So not fitting in, I stepped out and kind of realized that I better just take advantage of who I was. My hair was curly, so then I finally let it go curly rather than try to straighten it. And that's when things started ticking off, was when I was accepting myself for who I was.
Now, you've had a career on stage and in the movies. I want to ask you about a movie that you made called Pennies from Heaven, which is a film I really love. It never played very long. I know it didn't even get a lot of very good reviews, but I think it's a wonderful film. It's a movie adaptation of the British TV series Pennies from Heaven. that was originally written by Dennis Potter. And all the characters express their deepest emotions in moments when they lip-sync to the words of old pop records from the 20s and 30s. The story set during the Depression and the movie adaptation, Steve Martin played a sheet music salesman down on his luck during the Depression. He's in an unhappy marriage, too. And he falls in love with a spinster teacher played by you. And I'm figuring you must have really related to the idea of how well pop songs express our fantasies and express our emotions.
Oh, yes. I think, you know, I was just thinking maybe that's the world I got lost in when I was a child dreaming. Especially when I was a teenager, just singing. I used to love to take my lesson with my coach, Jim Gregory, and just sing songs, and all these emotions would come out. And it is a fantastic way to express your feelings.
Bernadette Peters, thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Bernadette Peters' new CD is called I'll Be Your Baby Tonight.
There's so much more embracing still to be done, but time is racing. Oh well, we'll catch up some other time.
Coming up, Harold Bloom's critique of millennial prophecies. This is Fresh Air. Many people are expecting something extraordinary to happen as the millennium approaches. Universal enlightenment, encounters with otherworldly beings, or the end of the world. But what literary critic Harold Bloom is hoping for is an end to the proliferation of crystals, angel books, and other New Age corruptions of ancient spiritual symbols. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Bloom's new book, Omens of Millennium.
You don't have to be Nostradamus to foresee that rationalists are in for a rough time of it over the next 5 years. Doomsday seers and Stonehenge shamans will be taking over the airways and internet to preach their visions of the rough beasts slouching towards Bethlehem, waiting to be born in the year 2000. As a protest against the idiocies perpetrated by the growing apocalypse industry, Harold Bloom has written Omens of Millennium. It's an awesomely learned and at times touchingly personal discussion of the ancient origins of such New Age marvels as angels, prophetic dreams, and near-death experiences. Bloom wants to encourage his readers, he says, to measure our current encounters with these phenomena against the best that has been known and written about them in the past. As a believer himself, Bloom doesn't want to debunk otherworldly manifestations, but to rescue them by restoring their more serious spiritual contexts. To accomplish this, Bloom surveys the key tenets of Zoroastrianism, Jewish Kabbalism, Christian Gnosticism, and Muslim Shiite Sufism. Along the way, he demonstrates that, contrary to the warm and fuzzy creed of the CBS television program, being touched by an angel is something that most humans, theologically speaking, have had reason to dread. The most interesting sections of Omens of Millennium deal with the sugarcoating of sacred images in our popular culture. In his chapter entitled Not Dying, Bloom discusses how the standard talk show account of a near-death experience, complete with a dark tunnel, an encounter with welcoming relatives, and a return or a mock resurrection scene, puts a cheerful spin on the terrifying accounts of shamans whose travels to the next world were initiated by bodily mutilations. Similarly, Bloom cites an apocalyptic text found among the Dead Sea Scrolls to counter those chummy images of angels currently floating on greeting cards and lapel pins. This ancient text opens with the descent unto earth of 200 rowdy angels looking for a good time with human females. Milquetoast Clarence from It's a Wonderful Life wouldn't have lasted a second with this bunch. Ironically, though, Omens of Millennium has the cumulative effect of making it clear why so many people prefer to swallow New Age pap rather than the tougher-to-digest religious texts Bloom cites. His argument is so staggeringly erudite and so, well, theologically picky that it's difficult for lay readers to keep up. We're treated, for instance, to not one, but three different versions of the Dead Sea Scrolls text on angels. Throughout his book, Bloom revels in the kind of mind-numbing exegesis that makes St. Thomas Aquinas the bane of college theology courses. Granted, these are problems that arise only when one is massively well-read, and Bloom remains our most capacious and curious literary critic. He identifies himself here as a Gnostic, heir to a heretical religious tradition that places the greatest value on the act of knowing. Unfortunately, in Omens of Millennium, Bloom didn't know when enough was enough.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Omens of Millennium by Harold Bloom. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.